Hello and welcome to a football podcast. My name is Devang Desai and I'm joined by the usual suspects, David Goss and Nick Andrade. This week we chat the MLS playoffs, wild games all over the place, look ahead to Tuesday's games, take you around the biggest headlines in Europe, and of course it's your questions on Ask AFP. Gentlemen, holy hell, what a weekend. My bracket is absolutely destroyed.
No, really?
I know, shocking, right?
I don't even know. Like, I think, I had NYSC. Oh, God. This is horrible.
I got Colorado wrong. Otherwise, I've gotten every other game correct. Thank you. You're welcome. But it's going to get blown up on Tuesday because Nashville's going to beat Toronto and LAFC is going to beat Seattle.
So if NYFCFC did not have a predilection for just torpedoing themselves, everything would have been fine. But we got a classic meltdown.
But Devang, they do that. That's why you don't pick them.
I know. And it's fool me once, shame, exactly fool me twice, right? Or the old W adage. But wow. I mean, I think MLS playoffs are great in itself, but it's fun to get other eyeballs, I guess, from other soccer fans who might not pay attention to the league till the playoffs. And then they realize that it is really up for grabs from the minute and from minute go. And I think that NYFC Orlando game lived up to the hype, David. That was great.
I would say, so like here in the US, college sports are huge. No one watches college sports because it's the best level of that competition. Because the NFL and NBA are clearly superior. You watch it because of the drama and the moments and all those things. And if MLS, if the playoffs are not the best quality, fair. But you cannot say anything in the world is more dramatic or more chaotic than what you saw. Like, I was pacing. My girlfriend was working on Saturday during the Orlando game, and her whole entire company knew that something was going on because I kept coming through screaming during the game. They're like, oh, did Orlando score? None of these people have ever watched a soccer game in their life. But I was freaking out the entire time. It was one of the wildest games I've ever watched.
Normally, with games that you don't really have an investment in, that game I was so nervous. And it's like, I don't care who moves through, but like, this is amazing and incredible, and I'm so nervous for what happens.
And in the end, we should have been cheering for Alan Chapman because he was the one who needed it the most.
He was living on the edge the entire game, and the Ruan nightmare 20 minutes that unfolded, I'm like, oh, okay, Alan kept it together, but of course.
You guys, the game was so wild, I forgot about the wheelchair. Juan had to fake an injury to try and avoid a red card, and then they brought a wheelchair onto the field. Oh my God, what a moment.
I just realized my bracket, I had Colorado in the West Final because I tried to be a kind of a rebel, and I have LAFC in Colorado, and it might be completely destroyed tonight.
Yeah, I had him in the MLS Cup Final, man. So
you had Colorado in the Final?
Yeah. I wasn't underselling what I said my bracket was busted. Hey, score some goals in the beginning of the second half, guys. Rapids, they should have. I don't know how they didn't. It's ridiculous. Shouts to Dwayne St. Clair and the Loons and the Loon Army, but man, that was read entirely wrong, and shouts to terrible defending because I think Wando does not score that incredible equalizer without some hilarious lapses at the back. But that's the playoffs, as you said, David. And I thought that game was great. I thought Portland collapsing like they seem to do as well at the end of games was kind of a Schadenfreude-esque moment. And then I thought Columbus responded really well to some early adversity. It was a really good week of games. And then, of course, the Premier League came back, Nick, and your guys looked pretty good.
Yeah, I thought that was a game that Liverpool lost 1,000%, especially the team that we put out. We put two kids in the lineup, and they managed. And they didn't just manage. They basically dictated the entire game. And I was like, wow, okay, we're winning the league again. Amazing.
One, I like that Nick calls them kids like they're his children.
Yes, they are. They are
so much. And the league's over, so that made things easier. We don't have to watch any more games.
It is. No, actually, I think Tottenham has a real shout right now. They look really good. Sean must be over the moon.
I tell one person a week at least that Tottenham could win the league to make sure that jinx is active, because I'm getting a little concerned now. It's father and
actually
nothing. Yeah,
I do notice that Devang on your Twitter, you definitely like throw that juju out there for Tottenham.
I say it a lot, right? You notice it, and it's all calculated. It's all planned. There's this is not just wild swings. These are jabs to make sure that the sports gods repay me in kind, because not only Spurs winning, I mean that, but Jose Mourinho winning there, we would reach a new level of shithousery talking everything that is the Mourinho experience. It'd be incredible.
If Mourinho wins a title with Tottenham.
At what cost, man? At what cost?
He's going to get a metal plaque that says world's greatest manager. He's going to have it melted into his chest. He's going to go shirtless for the rest of his life, and he's just going to walk around. It would be insane if it happened. I do not think it will happen, by the way, but it would be. But we'll talk about that more coming up.
It's a great, great tease, David, into a disturbing Spurs title winning nightmare future that we could live in. But before that, we're on Patreon, continuing our goal to get to 30. Once we do that, more interviews with players, execs, everyone, CPL, MLS, and the world of soccer, they could be yours. And also more packs, World Cup, Euro, whatever you guys want, we'll order them, plus access to our Discord chat, and then this episode ad free. So remember, head over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast and join today. Discord was bumping with MLS conversation, guys. I think incredulous reactions all around to the games, but I don't know if is it MLS that makes penalties more exciting, or is this just penalties in general? Because I think we're more prone to seeing the extreme happen in MLS PKs rather than others leagues.
I think anytime you have a league that has a situation where one game can lead to a penalty kick, that's when it's wild, because it's like less, it's not going to happen. It doesn't happen as often in Champions League because someone's going to score over the course of two games and whatever else is going on. But I think in Mexico, where it's a single game playoff as well, there's like penalty kick insanity all the time. Like that's like they sign up for that, and then like they happen to accidentally play soccer as well. So that's like kind of my vibe, is when you get in these situations where it's like just one game, it's just like a chippy 90 minutes, then you're straight into penalties. That's where like the wildness tends to happen.
That's the kind of cutting analysis you get on the Discord as well from David Goss. So remember to join us on patreon.com/afootballpodcast. After the break, we dive into that wild weekend in MLS playoff action. Welcome back to A Football Podcast. An absolutely incredible weekend of MLS playoff action, which started with the play-in games. Lean Win was on the show. Said New England was ready for their playoff debut under the second time around, I guess, under Bruce Arena. It went really well, and the big guns showed out. David, I thought from the beginning, Gustavo Bau and Carlos Gil were the best players on the field, and eventually that won out, though it took maybe longer than they would have wanted. An excellent goal, though, to win it, David. 95th minute, I believe. That's the way you want to win a game. I thought they deserved to go through, though. That's a New England team that deserved to make it on to play Philadelphia.
Yeah, I agree with you. They're the better team. Carlos Gil came out and was just on fire. And I think Nicolas Lodero's the most player in this category. And Pozuelo's similar, but a little more attacking, of just like pure activity. Like touching the ball every other touch for their team for a solid 25, 30 minutes. There are a few players in MLS that do that. And Carlos Gil, when healthy, is in that conversation, maybe not as goal dangerous as the other two, although gets a goal in this one as well. And he was awesome. And so, you know, New England threw all their attack to the left and gave a full side of the field for Tejan Buchanan, who was sort of debuting as a right back, to get forward and create opportunities. And his crossing could have been a little better. You probably see a 2-3 goal advantage. But I think for New England, you look at this game and you see, one, agree with what you said, and they definitely deserve to win. But two, the reason they were in this game was the reason that took them 95 minutes to win. They didn't close the game when they had opportunities. They made mistakes then, on the back end that Montreal had a few opportunities. Most of them came from New England mistakes. They struggled to cover ground at times in defensive midfield, and then they're out there like seventh string right back right now. And so Montreal, I thought, was the better team for a stretch of the second half. I'd say for the first 25, 30 minutes of the second half, Montreal, who looked like they were not even on the field in the first half, were the better team, which was kind of unacceptable to me that New England allowed them back in to Vang. But then they have match winners. And that's what we've talked about with Montreal. No one scores. No one creates chances unless Kyoto's weirdly having one of his good games. And that just wasn't the case in this one. And you kind of watch the game and you're thinking the only way Montreal is going to win is in penalties.
There was a couple glimpses from Boyan where I'm like, maybe, could it be that he took some attempts from distance? But that's exactly it. I think the problem with Montreal's entire year and why New England could be a dangerous team in the playoffs is that they have DPs who are good enough to win games. And if you don't have that in this league and you do have DPs, that's a massive problem. And I think Montreal will have to address what they're doing in that space, because New England seems to have found it out. If these guys stay healthy, then why not, right? And I think there's enough good MLS insulation around them. I thought Taj Buchanan was great, and I think I spammed your Twitter feed as well, repeating his name 80 times because he's Canadian, and I was like, yeah, which I deleted later.
He hit a cross that went out before the goal on his right foot. Besides that, though, he was very good and came inside and hit shots. We also have to mention Victor Wanyama not available for this game. Piet as well, but Wanyama is the only DP, I think, on the roster for Montreal. It was a bit of a loss. I don't know that it changes the result, but it would give them a little bit of like stability in the middle to kind of play through at times when they tried. Rudy Camacho played in there, and Rudy Camacho looked like when a center back goes forward and looks really uncomfortable for the full game. He like basically was out there like, why am I playing this position? And it looked that way.
It was troubling to watch. I think I'm putting it charitably. The other playing game, this was not a normal game. I think we talked about the international break restricting players coming back. Victor Wanyama himself could not play because he was returning from international duty with the Kenyan team. Inter Miami missed a lot of guys, David, but I don't think anyone really expected Nashville to put them out of their misery this emphatically with this nice of goals. I think, Leal can do that. I think this is the way Nashville finds success, much like New England. It's like if their best players show out, then maybe. And Leal, who's been getting better, I think in the beginning it wasn't just instant success, but that's a world-class strike. That's a goal that'll be scored in any league. And then I think Dax McCarty's like, hey, I might be the best player in this midfield in this game. And it showed it to be the case with a goal that I don't even think he was planning on scoring right to start the second half. I was a bit stunned, I'm going to be honest here. But you look at the manager, he's done it in this league before. You look at the players they had. Even if Inter Miami has all their players available, I wonder if this is the same result.
Yeah, so one of the things I think of when I look at teams and the way they play is floor and ceiling. And what Nashville did, they had a high floor. They have players who know this league, who have experience, who are steady. You kind of know what you're going to get. And then sometimes you're going to get a lot more than that. This was the first time ever the three DPs up front played together, because Yonder Cadiz came here much later, hadn't started. Leal was out with internationals. Hany Mukhtar has been injured. So that was like a big bonus for this team. And then Inter Miami, the range is massive. I mean, this was sort of a USL team at times for Inter Miami. They also have the ability to put multiple World Cup winners and LGP on the field. They just didn't have a lot of those players available for this game. The effort and the concentration from Inter Miami was borderline embarrassing, including from Blaise Matuidi, who's the World Cup winner, who wasn't tracking in midfield, didn't get back. Will Trapp was like 70 yards from the play. This is a guy who was like a national team player a year ago and is not over 35, so should probably still be relevant in this league. And then there was nothing in attack for Miami. And all of that's credit to Nashville. Nashville knows who they are. They know how they want to play. I thought Mukhtar was really good in the opening half. Active, getting on the ball, beating guys, willing to take the ball in pressure and get out of it. And that makes Lovitz a little bit more dangerous down that left side. And Cadiz is a legitimate threat. He can cushion the ball for those guys to kind of run off him. And his ability, or the recognition of him, I think stretches that back line, which gave space for Leal to hit that shot and create that opportunity. And it's taken Leal and Mukhtar the whole year to settle. And hopefully this means they are, but we've talked about this a couple times. attacking DPs from outside non-American, non-Canadians, it takes them a while sometimes. And Zeller Allen's hit the ground running, but I always go back to Sebastian Blanco was a failure for the first year until he found his feet. And now he's an MLS MVP candidate every time. So I think for Nashville, this was everything you wanted. A home game, a playoff win, you beat Miami, all these things, and now you can go into the second round. You're sitting on house money, and they did it in all the ways that they built this team to do it. And this was like the dream game all coming together at the same time, DeVang.
I guess it's the first time they scored a penalty as well. And this season came at the right time with Mukhtar scoring. I think it'll be a TFC win in this play-in game, or sorry, this first round game, but I'm not, this is not a high confidence pick. I'm saying maybe a 65-60% pick, which is fair. I don't think
that's the way Nashville plays, right? Because they're not going to get blown out, so it will always be tight.
And like, if MLS guys TM, which is the new recurring segment, but they have so many of them that it did exactly what they were supposed to do, and exactly what you're referring to in terms of that's the floor and the ceiling. Dangerous team, especially in the playoffs. Okay, it's the wild one. It was the game that I think probably alongside LAFC in Seattle, maybe the most anticipated first round matchup, really did live up to the hype. Orlando City, NYCFC, Galese, I'm like, the first half, NYCFC should have probably scored 3 goals. It should have been game over. We're talking about the next round. Orlando makes the playoffs, but they go out in a pretty uninspired display. But no, their keeper is incredible. He came back from the internationals. He somehow made it back. That's private charters paid off. And then we got like almost like a soap opera type playing of the second half, in which the Rouen debacle and the fact that, I think to me, David, this the better team did not advance in this game. But yeah. I think the better team over the course of this season, and the better team going forward for the playoffs did, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think even with the result, and maybe Orlando won't say it because it's their first ever playoff win and they're focused on that, they have to be disappointed in the performance. Chris Mueller just didn't show up for this game. They created opportunities for him to be 1v1. That's where he thrives. That's what they need. And he just wasn't able to create anything, beat anyone. DK was kind of a non-factor for a lot of this game. Huan not able to create dangerous opportunities when he got into space. And Pereira, I don't think, was as effective as he's been throughout this season. So I thought for Orlando, there was a lot to not be happy with. But the moment I go back to is Nani gets fouled. He goes down in like the 65th, 70th minute. And Castellanos comes over and says something to him. And Nani jumps up, gets in his face, shoves him. Antonio Carlos is there. It gets everyone involved. And that moment on was when the game became manageable, as if, okay, Orlando's actually going to stay in this. Because, like you said, it should have been 3-1 at halftime, even with Orlando going up 1-0. And it probably should have been 4-5-1 at that point. And the game just became chaos. And Orlando was there for the street fight if they weren't there for the soccer game. And they were able to hang around because of that. And from the moment they went man down, when Huan got one of the most obscene red cards and then had to get taken off on the wheelchair and go to the locker room where Oscar Pereja then ran to go meet him when he didn't win a penalty kick shootout, but he thought he did because everything like that happened in this game. That's Orlando was better than NYCFC. NYCFC had no ideas. And DeVang, I know you saw it last year with Toronto. Like, Toronto came in last year in that first round on short rest with no one healthy, and NYCFC never knew how to win that game. They were always the better team. They never knew how to win the game. That's exactly what happened in this one, and that's my exact fear about this team. And at some point, I think, sadly, I think you just need to get an ace guy up front to finish for you to win games like this. Raul Ruiz Diaz, Josie Altidore, Joseph Martinez, they finish in those moments, and that's the thing that NYCFC doesn't have. And it seems like they're not able to get over the hump without it.
I'll be so bold to say the NYCFC project has been a failure up to this point. And the fact that they are still a clown show in the playoffs is absolutely an indictment. And I think this club in general, to get slightly serious, I think the reporting we saw in The Athletic this week about David Villa and his actions, and the fact that the club clearly knew what was going on based on the reporting and chose not to act, I think from the top down, what can you say? I'm glad they're out. Honestly, glad they're out. I we were in our group chat, I was saying, Gary Mackay, Steven, what a treat to watch. No, get out of here, New York City FC. We don't want to see you again. The other favorites, quote unquote, the favorites, perhaps, in the East.
We got to talk about the penalty kick shootout and everything else that happened. This was an all-time MLS moment. This is, sadly, maybe not sadly, I'm not like that offended by it because I loved everything that happened, but Galese gets the red card after they thought they won, and it's like, what's happening? Then they try and bring Brian Rowe in, and no one knows the rules of professional soccer in this moment that he can't sub on. And then a backup center back steps up and saves a penalty kick. Then Orlando thought they won, and then Benji Michel's forced to step up.
The greatest part to me among many was the fact that Orlando thought they won before they actually did, because imagine that they did miss that following ensuing kick.
Yeah, but true.
This might sound shocking, but I'm going to come out in defense of Alan Chapman and his crew, because it seems like they're not going to work another playoff game based on a report on the broadcast during that San Jose game. Which I think is harsh. Nobody knew the rules. Like you said, literally nobody knew the rules. Nobody in the announcing crew knew the rules. And in fact, the idea that they were fostering this kind of confusion was because nobody knew what was going on. And as Alan Chapman is trying to work this out with the crew on the field, I think because there was this kind of swelling of uneasiness about what we actually do here, it felt like it was more shambolic than maybe it actually was. So I will defend Alan Chapman in this regard.
So two things. One, and I don't know what was going on in his head. Apparently, IFAB has changed the rule, but the way MLS works, MLS kicks off weirdly. IFAB makes their ruling changes in the middle of the MLS season because MLS is quote unquote off from the European leagues. So when IFAB makes a change, it doesn't go until the next season. So IFAB's made a change where the Pedro Gallese coming off his line would have been a warning. And therefore, it wouldn't have been a yellow card immediately. The other thing is, which I'm not 100% on, but I'm 90% on, is it seems like IFAB's also eliminated yellow cards counting. So it would have been a yellow card. If it had been a yellow card, the other yellow card would not have existed anymore. You can't get a second yellow to get kicked out in penalty kick shootouts going forward. You have to get a straight red or two yellows in the penalty kick shootout. I don't know how much of that was in Alan Chapman's brain. It's his job to know the other way. I think the worst moment was when Brian Rowe was taken off and then allowed to come back on and then pushed back off again. That was the moment where it was like, if you know this rule, you're getting this done. It took about 7 minutes to get through that whole experience. That was the part I think was a little bit unacceptable. But I'm here for you to defend him because he needs somewhere to go so he can quarantine with you after all this is over.
The whole perhaps the referee should know the rules part, I think my argument might be a bit weaker than I initially suspected. He should probably know that, right? But I don't know. I think it added to the beauty of it all, and I think it's a perfect beginning, I think, to this round of playoffs, and Orlando staying in. I mean, Nani himself is almost a caricature now. The fact that he still works really hard, and I feel like some of the Orlando players began to let on a vibe of like not letting him down after he stared down Castellanos and was like, hey guys, like what the hell's going on here? He was giving death stares to everyone, and Ruan acting out the way he did, I was like, this is a guy who's scared maybe of disappointing Nani, and like this is the way you can see a team maybe defy limitations like on the field, which I don't think they have that many. This is a good team, and I am personally glad they're through. Columbus Red Bulls, were you surprised to see Red Bulls go up early, David? Because I was like, this should be a pretty routine game for a crew team that is overall better, but I was a bit shocked by the opening.
Well, I will say this, by the time Red Bull scored, I still not had emotionally recovered from Orlando, smoking a cigarette in bed, drinking a whiskey, trying to get myself back up. I needed pieces of chocolate, like I had dealt with a Dementor. It was so much to go through, so I wasn't really surprised. I wasn't surprised the way the game played out. Yeah, scoring first, second, a little bit, but it was always going to be Red Bulls trying to be scrappy, pressing their moments, and that's what the goal was. So I wasn't surprised by the way it happened, especially a rainy day in the playoffs. under a new coach. Like, it was a lot of weird things happening, and it was really just failed clearance, battling. Caden Clark smashes a ball into the ground that goes in. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't clean. And Devang, I think that was always going to be the game plan for New York. And then late in the game, they were going to throw on pressure when they needed to. And they have always, since the Jesse Marsh era began, when they are losing in games, they've thrown numbers forward. They've gotten close. And everyone kind of says to themselves, why didn't they do this earlier? Oh, they could have created chances. But it's not real. It's a paper lion. And it always kind of fails for them.
It's not sustainable over that period of time that you need to do it either, right? I think that's not the greatest stadium in general, but without fans, Matt Free looks like a very interesting place to play. I thought it was maybe the most haunting setting for a playoff game this weekend, but the Crew get through.
I love Matt Free. I just got to throw that out there. It's got a place in my heart.
I don't mind. It's a dump. It's got feeling. But like the press box has like an obstructed view. Yeah. It's really interesting how the press box is put in a position where you can probably see less of the game than anyone else there. And yet the people sitting in the press box are tasked with talking about the game, but they cannot see the same feel that the people sitting in the fans can see. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. That's the East. TFC Nashville, like we mentioned, Tuesday night. It'll be a big game, but the Western Conference, David, we really trashed San Jose. Like, we said they have no chance. They're hopeless. Clowns, goons. Their coach is going to leave. The ownership isn't serious. Some of those things are still true, but they worked their tail off.
Did we call them clowns
off.
Or goons?
I did.
Did we say
I did.
Those words?
I did off air. I did off air. But we know they were going to work. We know they were going to work. And they did. Almost shocking SKC. I mean, I know Orlando, New York City FC gets the MLS stamp of what the hell's happening approval, but this Wando's goal, I'm like, this is also like this league, man, this league.
The all-time leading goal scorer in history who had 30 seconds, 2 minutes earlier, had a point-blank chance saved and you leave him open on the back post. What else are you doing? Like, what else is your responsibility in that moment as a center back? And that was the case on all the goals for San Jose. It was just either it was breakdowns in central midfield, allowing easy runners, or these two center backs, Winston Reid and Roberto Puncic, just falling asleep for SKC. And coming into this playoffs and into this game, that was my question mark for this team. They were weak defensively. They had lapses. They had issues, but they were dangerous offensively. Nothing has changed in that. They tied 3-3, so they scored goals. They were not able to defend, and Tim Melia is one of the best goalkeepers in MLS. Makes the huge save on Wando, and then makes three saves in a row in the penalty kicks, which is just absurd, and yet is the second most absurd penalty kick shootout we had this weekend. With San Jose, this is what you were going to get, though, because the games are wild, but there's no consistency both in games and over the course of time, and so they were never going to make a run in this playoffs. That's what I always felt. I would not have been shocked if they won this game. I would have been shocked if they won the next game as well. And you saw why in this game. They don't create moments. They don't control the game at any point in the playoffs. At some point, if you're ahead, you need to put your foot on the ball and slow the game and play it at the tempo you want it to be played at. And San Jose is completely incapable of doing that. And so they give you energy. They give you wild moments. They get the goals, all of which were wild attempts that hit off eight people and went in and probably all should have been own goals. And yet they don't have the way to control the game and win it. And that's kind of what you saw in the end here. I think Devang was, they actually played better in extra time, but they had no way to break through once SKC kind of dropped their lines and accepted that they were going to penalty kicks. And this was an SKC team that wasn't perfect, but they're about to get their best player back in Alan Pulido. And so I cannot write them off yet, even though I feel like I want to.
I've never seen a team look as hopeless as San Jose did stepping up for the PKs. Like, there was no belief whatsoever that they were going to come out of this successfully. I wasn't sure if it was Tim Melia or Kira Cedric in goal, because that was the closer. It was just, he's the stopper. That's the most impressive PK goalie probably in the league right now. I still think, even though I picked Colorado to make it out of the West, that in that Minnesota SKC matchup, David, the Loons have what you need to excel in the playoffs. The game against Colorado, I mean, I think they did get kind of fortunate. I thought if Colorado can cash in some of those chances early on in the second half, it's a totally different game, but obviously they didn't. And Minnesota gets gets enough from the attacking. I mean, like the Kevin Molino, Adrian Heath thing, David, I think is one of the cooler stories as well. And the fact that these guys have been basically together since the beginning, and Molino's battled through horrendous injuries. He comes into this playoff game, scores two huge goals. But I think the strength of Minnesota matches up well with SKC. Do you think that's fair to say? Because I like them in that potential semifinal.
I agree with you, and I think Minnesota is going to score goals in this game, but I think KC will too, especially if Pulido's healthy. Pulido's healthy, it changes everything, because when he's on top of the box, you have to step to him because he's so dangerous there, and that allows Russell and Gerso those lanes on the side of the box to get in and either a pullback or a finish for themselves, and that's when KC's at their best. So he adds that, plus the ability to finish as well that Kyrie Shelton just doesn't really have. I think you're looking at a 3-3, a 3-2 game between these two next time. And it's just who's able to create more chances. But for sure, Minnesota has exactly what you want against KC, which is Reynoso pulling those strings at the 10, pulling center backs towards him, and Molino and Load and Finley's speed and creativity off of him to beat guys in transition. And that's what Minnesota is going to try and do. And they were pretty good at it. I'll bet you money, I haven't seen it yet, that expected goals, Colorado, Minnesota ended up even. That's how dangerous Colorado actually was. And they just were nowhere close on their finishing. And that was kind of the question mark for them coming into this. It's goals by committee. And sometimes when that happens, it turns out that's because no one's an elite goal scorer and no one was able to find the finish. But this was a weird game to kind of fall after the KC game, because it didn't feel like it had the intensity level of the game before and the day before, but it had that quality from Minnesota that Colorado just couldn't match.
The Timbers are out in a marathon penalty session against Dallas. I will be straight up with you, David. I think Portland's weakness at the back in late games would have been covered by the fact that they generally have more game breakers than Dallas and other teams in the West. But it was kind of weird and also comforting that it went exactly to script. And like every single deficiency that we've seen from the Timbers this year basically did them in when they shouldn't have even been in this situation to get to penalties. So it basically the sum of all of the issues kind of led to this early exit, and it's fair.
There's also like a conversation we have to have at some point about MLS, where this league's improved even with like some of the insanity and chaos. Felipe Mora started for Chile in World Cup qualifying last week. They won games in South American World Cup qualifying, and he was like terrible in this game. He's worse than Jeremy Abobasi and Neish Gota, who don't play for their national team, which is like a pretty good national team. So the league has changed a lot in that way. And I think for Portland, listen, we talked about Wanyama missing for Montreal. We've talked about other players. Sebastian Blanco is the best player on this team, and Neish Gota is their DP center forward. And Jeremy Abobasi was not fit to play in this game. And then Eric Williamson goes out hurt. So Portland has full excuses. And I kind of came in on them hot right after the game. I felt the same way, Devang. And then someone talked me down and I was like, I think they'll be fine for 2021, I guess is my point. I think the way they're set up is correct if everyone's healthy, or some people are healthy. But in this game, it was unfortunate that they still didn't have the ideas of how to close this game out, how to not just cede possession to Dallas and let them just dump balls in the box over and over again. And in the end, Dallas probably should have won this game on the run of play. Hara misses a chance. Pepe has the one saved by Clark before he equalizes. All those things. And then it was a pretty phenomenal penalty kick shootout. Like, we're talking corners. It was seven rounds and everyone hit one in the corner until that final Jorge Villafana chance gets saved. And I didn't want Dallas to play this way. I wanted them to be aggressive. I wanted to see what we saw last year in the Seattle playoff game. They didn't do it. They kind of relied on the veteran guys a little bit, maybe too much. And I'd be interested to see if Lucci goes with Ricuarte again in central midfield, because I thought he was pretty poor and he's pretty slow of thought, physically slow. Maybe you get more energy in there with a Tessman or someone else, but credit to Dallas. I mean, this is a team that after Pareja left, they were kind of floating. I love Lucci Gonzalez. I've known him for a number of years. I would play for him. Like, I would run through a wall for him now if he asked me to. But there was question marks about how they build an MLS contender, and they're in the Western Conference semifinals, and that's all you can ask for, I think.
kind of easy to forget. Portland won MLS's back, so it's not an entirely bad year. I mean, like, my also takes are based on the regular season play, but we look quickly forward to the games on Tuesday. Still like Philly, TFC, and LFC to get through, David?
No, I have Seattle. So I have Philly, Toronto FC, and Seattle. I've basically gone chalk outside of the Dallas game this whole tournament, and I've gotten all but one right. I can't imagine New England being able to recover on short rest. It's a Friday night to Tuesday against a team that's on full rest and has already beaten you four times this year and is better than you and has multiple plays to win and plays at home. So that it would surprise me if New England lost. But again, Gustavo Bo and Heal, when they're on, are good enough to win a game like that. Nashville, Toronto, I think is going to be fascinating because Nashville just wants to sit deep and they're so organized. And it doesn't really give room for an Ayo Akinole to make runs behind. And I don't think they'll be physically overwhelmed by him at center back like we've seen in other games. So it's really going to fall on Pasuelo. And then where are you getting the rest of the attack? Is it Piatti being healthy? Is it Richie Larea making runs from fullback? That's going to be interesting to me, Devang. That's where the game's going to be won. Who steps up alongside Pasuelo to try and pull this back line apart and create chances?
I forgot to mention this, but Ricardo Pepe, if he played on not Dallas or on a bigger market, quote unquote, I feel like he would be talked about a lot more. I love watching him in that Portland game as well.
Devang.
Great weekend. Yeah, please.
I live on the Ricardo Pepe train for 2 years now. Since he's been 15 years old, I'm living on the Ricardo Pepe train. This is the set. Everyone always goes, Josh Sargent, who's going to be the forward? And I've been telling people for 2 years now, just wait for Pepe. It's fine. This guy's a cold-blooded finisher. I don't think we've ever had an American who's played, maybe Clint Mathis, but couldn't stay healthy, who plays like he plays. And he can do other things, but the way he plays is so different, and he's 17. That is absurd. I don't know if you saw this stat, but in MLS history, only one player under the age of 19 had scored in a playoff game coming into this weekend. Yeah, that was Josie in 2006. Three did it this weekend. Three. That is crazy.
Great news, folks. Another sick young American. Like, they don't have enough of them. Yay. Okay.
Dane St. Clair. That's MLS. Shut out in the playoffs.
Dane St. Clair. Fantastic. Wonderful. Kamar Miller as well. I thought he was great for Orlando when he came on. Added some pace. After the break, a trip to Europe. The Prem is back. And La Liga is a beautiful sight with the Giants really struggling. We chat about it right after the break.
Welcome back to a football podcast. And guys, now we turn our attention to Europe. And first, England, of course, with the EPL. And we start with Tottenham. They beat Manchester City pretty handily. Man City, it's their worst start to the season in the new owner era, I would say. And Pep also, though, he signed a new extension. So it begs the question, but let's start with the game, and what do you think of the performance from Tottenham, guys?
That's the way Tottenham can play. It's pretty much expected now. They're going to rely on the counter. They have absolute stars up front that will punish you when they get one chance. Harry Kane might be the best playmaker in the league right now, and if the way they use him varies like Jose likes to do, I think the way how deep he was playing against City was the perfect foible for Pep's game plan. I'm on the record, I think Tottenham can win the league this year based on what we've seen so far and the fact that it looks like there'll be more parity at the top. But I have way more questions for City. I'm frankly stunned that Pep signed that extension. I mean, this looks a bit like a rudderless ship in terms of player acquisition and all of the guys that basically they've relied on to win all of the stuff were people that were there before Pep came. And I think the guys that they have brought in since, it's worth asking what are they being judged on? What is Pep being judged on? And I understand he is one of the best in the game, if not the best, but I thought the extension was a bit shocking to me based on what we're currently seeing and what we expect to see going forward, because it almost seems like a hopeless mission for this thing going forward.
I agree with you, but then Ferran Torres goes and scores a hat trick for Spain and Mahrez won an AFCON last year as the best player in Africa. And it's like, you also can't knock the player acquisition because there's quality there. And so that's the part that's really hard to me is like, they're so good.
Look, I don't think he's buying bad players. Like, that's, I'm not saying that. I think the idea is that he literally can spend whatever he wants. And I think at a certain point, we have to ask, what does that mean? Like, what are we, what he, and I still think they could win the league this year because it is that random, yeah, but how are we grading Pep? Because it feels like it's thrown out the window any sort of like conventional grading system.
I agree with you. I think I wouldn't be surprised if Man City won the league this year. It's going to be a low point season. It's going to be chaos. It's going to be wild. And yeah, with Man City, it does feel like they just get a ton of talent and it kind of all gets thrown together. At the same time, they've played soccer at times under Pep. That's probably better than what anyone's ever done in Premier League history. And so you can see why you give a guy like that an extension. One, he's charismatic. Two, there's no one who can do what he does. So where do you go from here if you're Man City? Because you know it's going to be a step down, and how do you take that step down, I think, is really tough. So I understand why they would extend him. Some people are saying this is purely a Messi play, that Pep has that ability to get Messi to come, and we know Messi's going to be on a free at the end of this year, so is that a way to get him there? Does that even fix everything? I don't know. I think there's a lot of question marks here.
My confusion is more based on from the Pep side. Like, Manchester City should lock this in, and you're totally right. Like, who else do you get? This is not a Ferguson Wenger type thing, but I think it is equally like, who the hell are you going to bring in that can command the room like Pep Guardiola? But what's in it for him? Like, I am not a body language expert. I don't know what exactly I'm reading into, and this is pop psychology at its finest, but like, it doesn't look like he's super enjoying himself most of the time. And it's not like he's always had extreme joy in his face, but he's going through the motions. Yeah.
I wonder though, if he knows the narrative of Pep comes in, works hard, does something, and then leaves and can't fix a problem or won't be able to. And I wonder if he knows that. I also think everything else is dried up. Unless he goes national team or back to Barcelona, there probably isn't another job out there for him. So if he wants to manage, this is probably the place to do it. Now, he could do whatever he wants, right? Mourinho's done that. Like, yeah, he could go and manage Leicester. No one's going to say no, of course, it's Pep Guardiola, but it just wouldn't really make sense conventionally for him. So I think there's a level of that as well, as like, this is now his project. And I think he's worked with academy kids. He's worked with youth there. Like, he's tried to build a club, but it's been a struggle to get it to come together over this last year and a half, 2 years again. And it's tough because I think, one, they probably should have gotten a result in this game. Like, Gabriel Jesus blocked a De Bruyne shot while laying on the ground. Jesus handled that one that he knocked down for Laporte that he didn't need to and still would have been a goal. Like, there was moments here, and you're missing Sterling out of all that, who's the second best player on the team. So there's those moments there. For Tottenham, this is what Mourinho was always going to do, and it's credit to him. And at the same time, this team isn't, I don't think, better defensively than they were under Pochettino, and I don't think they're better offensively. It was always, if Harry Kane and Son were healthy, this team was good. I think they have more depth now, so they can cover for them. That's where they can win a title, to me, as you look at this game and Lo Celso's on the bench, Gareth Bale's on the bench. You have, what's it called? Ben Davies on the bench now that you've brought in Reguilon. You have more depth, and that's what you need to win a title. But from best 11, this is where Tottenham's been under Pochettino. That's why they went to a Champions League final, because these players have this quality.
And we move on to Arsenal. They draw Leeds and Nicolas Pepe with a little bit of a headbutt to bang. What do you think about that?
Was a headbutt. Absolute disaster. Man spent his international break with Cote d'Ivoire basically asking for more playing time for Mikel Arteta, saying he needs to play more. And I honestly was all on board. I think a large segment of Arsenal fans want to see Nicolas Pepe play more. And to do what he did there, I mean, extremely disappointing. I mean, right after the game and during it, I'm like, he might not play again, and this might be the last we've seen of Nicolas Pepe, but I don't think that'll necessarily be the case. The response, I mean, good. I think the mettle and the strength and defensive spine of this team is definitely something Arteta's infused, but before that, the first half, nearly unwatchable. This team cannot score goals from open play. It's a problem. I think it's all beyond 7 hours now, and that penalty against United is basically the last time they found the net in league play. It's a mess. I think the issue is, and I'm curious what you think, David, but I think Jose Mourinho, he knows exactly what he wants in his squad, the players he wants, and he's won out, and I think Hoiberg's an example of someone that fits his system really well. He's playing it perfectly. Mikel Arteta knows his system, and he's found that he can adapt, and it's the 3-4-3 against the big teams. Then maybe, like he did against Leeds, you can go to a 4-2-3-1. It's the players in those roles, they don't necessarily fit the ability that they have to make the system go. And I think it might be a thing that Arteta needs to acknowledge, is that the rigidity that they play with in this system, how set everything is, does not work unless the players are up to that certain level of ability. So at that point, can you adjust? And I think the question is, we need to see an adjustment being made there from Arteta going forward.
I totally agree with you. And part of it is like, well, Arteta didn't sign Aubameyang, right? He didn't sign Lacazette. He didn't sign Pepe. Like, all of this was done before him, and he's trying to do what he can with it. I think a lot of those players are best in transition. They're best when the game's open. They're best running at players. They're not great in moments where they have to play against a lower block and try and break that down. I think Thomas Partey helps that because he's just so good, and he has an ability to make things happen that shouldn't happen. And that's how you change a soccer game, is beat a guy 1v1, have a moment where you slip a pass that no one sees, unnerve a defense. Partey has that ability. I don't know that a lot of other people in this team do. And it is a question of, okay, so Arteta's roster is here. He wants it to be 10 steps different. How does he play soccer over the time that it takes to get his roster to that point? Because there's talent here. But to your point, it's not talent that fits into his system the way he wants it to. So what is he going to do? And I think it's an interesting question, because on one level, he's trying to rebuild a club. He doesn't want to step away from his principles. But on the other side, you can't wait 3 years to get the results you want. Like, you need to be able to get something out of Willian and out of Pepe and out of these guys, because they're talent and that's what you have there. So I think it's a really good question mark. And Pepe's the example, because you see him in his head when he's playing. Everything's over dribbled. He doesn't know where he wants to go with the ball. And the talent is there, and none of the production is there. And then you see these moments of frustration, which, you know, this is a club that has Ozil currently sitting at home on social media blasting off. Not saying that they're the exact same thing, but it just shows you the frustration.
The thing is, and like, if you're an Arsenal supporter and you don't acknowledge this, then I can't help you. But Mesut Ozil would make this team better right now. This is something that also has to be acknowledged as well. And the fact that it's not, I mean, it's extremely tough, because I definitely am with the manager, but I have some questions about what exactly is going on player deployment wise. It's interesting. I mean, some days it's like, oh, he's going to leave for greener pastures because he's too good. And some days everyone wants to fire him. It's hilarious. And it's basically a problem that is not single to Arsenal, don't get me wrong. But I think there is like this maelstrom of post-Wenger angst that is just impossible to quench no matter what happens.
So let me ask you this, Devang. There was years where Arsenal was creative and couldn't stop anyone. Now, they're resolute defensively and they can't score. Do you take this? Like, are you okay with the full switch?
This is the problem, I think, because yes, we should. 100% should. The lament for years and years and years, and it doesn't matter who the players have been, is the fact that there is no backbone at all with this club, and there is no stick-to-itiveness, and they wouldn't go down a man in battle for 40 minutes. So I think you have to acknowledge that. But I think the other issue is you are invested pretty heavily in a bunch of guys that are only getting older, right? I think the fact that we played Fulham right away might have been the biggest disaster, because it perhaps made us think that Willian could do all of those things against other clubs, but I think it was just Fulham. So Rhys Nelson got on. I thought that Rhys Nelson got on. That was great. Martinelli could be back soon. Saka got hurt at the end. But when Saka came on, it was literally him and Abba that were the only people doing things. There are pieces there, but it's patience. It's just an extremely bizarre fan base. It's really interesting.
Moving on, Liverpool handily beat Leicester with a mountain of injuries. But most interesting, Jurgen Klopp, his post-game analysis with Sky Sports, basically going off on the schedule and saying that you guys need to give us a break. What do you guys think about his relentlessness in talking about the schedule?
There's one thing I love about Jurgen Klopp, which is the, like, we've all been in these trenches, and Jurgen Klopp was like coaching in Germany, wasn't paying attention, came to England and was like, here are all the things that are stupid about the English schedule. And everyone else already knows that. But then Jurgen Klopp's doing that thing where it's like he thinks he invented the ideas. So he's like now preaching them from the top of the mountain, which I appreciate. One of the things that's blown my mind over the last 5 months or so is I thought that with COVID-19 and the change in the world and the way things happen, that this was going to be a space for sports organizations to be really creative, to say, listen, there's nothing we can do about this, so we're going to do things differently. You saw it a little bit with the NBA bubble, I think, of like the playing games and the way they set it up and all that stuff. But otherwise, everyone's basically said like, no, this is what we do. And I think that's been wrong. I think this is an opportunity to have a little creativity and say like, yeah, let's move schedules around. Let's change games. Let's change the amount of subs you're allowed to have. Let's do all these things to see if we can make this get through this easier. And then what sticks for the future, right? Because like, this is a weird history reference, but I follow history. It's like a lot of things are invented in wartime, and it's medical changes and all that stuff because it's just like chaos and you have to get stuff done. And that's when things stick based on what works. And we haven't seen that at all, especially in England. The like necessity to just jam these exact amount of games into the schedule, to force players to play the exact amount of time, to have these international breaks, which isn't England's fault. That's FIFA, which was so wild. And I'm just kind of shocked, Devang, and I think Klopp's point makes sense of just how dogmatic everyone has been about trying to keep things normal when it's not normal.
100% right. And it's a testament to, I think, who is running these organizations and the fact that it's impossible to get out of the cement they basically poured for themselves in enacting schedule changes, broadcast changes. They ditched the pay-per-view scam, not scam, but pretty much we'll call it what it was, which was extorting fans to pretty high degrees in terms of a single match fee. I think Klopp is, I'm not going to say like he's got bad intentions, but he's definitely saying the right things. They know the bet that they made with these organizations. The reason they can spend the money that they're spending, the fees that they're getting, like they've made these deals with the TV companies because it allows them to be Liverpool or be Man United or be any sort of big club in England. So I think it's a bit, it makes me smile a bit where I'm like, okay, yeah, like 100%. But also, man, like you're part of the problem. Club is part of the problem. Like I think you can talk to your guys as well about this because the player's safety is, I don't know. He's right. But also like check inside the house.
Well, I think to that point, you come out of this game and I'm not going to talk about Liverpool fans, right? Don't worry, Nick. I got you. But it's like, wow, Liverpool, they're geniuses. Like, they were so good. And then they found Diego Jota out of nowhere and brought him in. It's like, you spent $50 million on that. Like, to Devang's point, like, you're pumping money into this team. And a lot of it comes straight from your ownership. But they do it because they're making money back. This is not something that's being done on the back of a napkin. And this isn't Moneyball. So, yeah, Devang, I agree with you. If you are part of that system, it's fun to rail against it when you know it's never going to change.
Just get rid of the international breaks. If it's not for qualifying, don't have them right now. There's no point.
Yeah. I don't think there's one till March now, which also sets up really well for Spurs. Look out.
Barcelona is beaten by Atletico for the first time in a decade. Uh-oh. Trouble in paradise. Is Ronald Koeman in trouble? What's going on at Barcelona, guys?
He was in trouble the day he took the job. I don't understand why he left the Netherlands. I get it. It's Barcelona. It's a once-in-a-lifetime chance. He played there, blah, blah, blah. He was in trouble because this team, the way they built themselves in originally under Pep was tiki-taka, which means you have so much possession that you don't need elite defenders in the regular way other teams do. And now they don't have the ability to dominate possession. They don't score a ton of goals and you're just susceptible at the back. And you saw that in this one, Atletico Madrid, they love to play tight games. They like it to be close and condensed and take advantage of their moments. And that's what this game was. Barcelona doesn't have the attack right now outside of Messi to create a ton of opportunities. Atletico Madrid hits on the counter, Ter Stegen in no man's land, and Carrasco finishes. And then that's where Atletico's in their zone, because then they can allow you to do whatever they want. They can press you in moments, but they can sit as a block and defend. And this was always going to be trouble for Barcelona. This was kind of a moment, I think, for Atletico Madrid, and they're going through a change as well in their roster, but less significant than what Barcelona is doing. And so this is going to be a problem. I think Devang, if Messi leaves this year, obviously tough, but if he does, I think this is a moment to reset this roster and say, we need a match winning center back and we need to build from the back here, because they have pieces that can create. They have Fati, they have Trincao, they have guys who are going to make goals at some point, but you need to be able to trust your back line.
He wasn't super great in this game, but I feel like João Félix was written off extremely quickly for reasons that are unknown. I think the curse of Defi is also always a thing, but being super young.
Narrative, and baby.
Yeah, and you got to be great right away or you suck, but he's been great. This is what they wanted. He wasn't super great in this game specifically, but I think what he does is kind of new for Atletico. And it's like, are they an attacking fun team now? Like, is this what's going to happen? And Yannick Carrasco coming back. I mean, another player, we're like, oh, he's leaving for Asia. Is he going to be the same player when he comes back? Another revelation for Atletico Madrid. This is, I mean, it's November 24th when this comes out, and Barcelona is closer to the bottom than they are the top, and it's far, far away. Real Sociedad, legit. Real Madrid is in the conversation still. I think Barcelona, we can say, are not going to be in this race. Incredible.
Yeah.
And that's it for European headlines. When we come back, Ask AFB. Welcome back to A Football Podcast. It is now time for everyone's favorite mailbag segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send your own questions, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. First question goes to Cameron, and he asks, how long should/does a DP get in MLS if they're not playing at DP levels? I guess he's talking about get in time.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and something I sort of touched on in that Nashville convo. Attacking players, you have to give them a year. This league is super unique. The travel's the biggest one, but the styles from each different team and the way the season flows, the heat that you play at, all these things are unique, and it seems like it's harder to come in as an attacker. At the same time, Jonathan Mensah was a train wreck his first year in MLS. Lauren Simon was a train wreck in his first 2-3 months. Jonathan Mensah, I voted for Defensive Player of the Year, Defender of the Year this year in MLS, and Simon went on to have a much better run. So all across the board, I think you have to understand how unique this league is to give players time to settle in, and also their projects. Are they coming into a team that's somewhat formed where they have a defined role? Are they coming into a team and there's a lot relied on them out of nowhere in a new society, all these types of things? So I think for the most part, I give them a year. And I also look at their teams, Devang, and the one that stands out to me right now is Pedro Santos. We all wrote off because he wasn't good enough. Well, he's good enough to be the second or third option on a team that's still designated player level. And now he's doing it because they have Zellerion, they have Nagby, they have Zardes. So I think there's a lot of factors that go in, but safely, I normally give players a year before I start asking questions.
I think I generally agree. I wonder if like the Cincinnati example might be like one of those outliers where you're pretty confident these are not the people that should be taking up DP wages and you have to do better there. But overall, I think, especially 2020, like it is an absolute cluster F to navigate, and especially the fact that, let's say, for example, you are coming over from Europe or a non-North American setting, this league is different, super different, plus you have places and regions you cannot go to because of the pandemic, so maybe the timeline is extended. That being said, like, there are some examples of it just not clearly working extremely early, and cutting it earlier than later is the best course.
And I will say this last one, which is, for the most part, there are some where the players don't do the right thing. They don't hit. But there's a lot where it's the front office that just got it wrong.
100%. 100%.
And there's a lot where teams are dying for a little bit more. I think of Chicago right now and Ali Seda just giving them zero offensively and then missing the playoffs by a point. And if Chicago had done anything else with that DP spot, they'd be in the postseason this year.
Mike asks, did they miss anyone in the MLS Best 11, in your opinion?
Probably Tinnerholm. I generally don't have any issues with the actual 11, but the fullback hatred, the plan, the grand plan against fullback inclusion in the best 11 continues unabated, and it's sad to see. Tannerholm should have made it in.
So I agree with you. I think when I look at this year's best 11, because no one played each other and the season was so weird, I think that there are 15 or 16 players that deserve it, and I don't knock anyone that's on it. Chris Mueller probably deserves it. I didn't vote for him. And then since I didn't, I've kind of looked at the numbers, and I think I may have been wrong. I think Giassi Zardes deserves a shout. He didn't get on. I voted for him. Rui Diaz, though, also deserves to be there. Robert Berich also probably deserves to be there. And then Jose Martinez, in my mind, was the best defensive midfielder, but he only played in 14 games. Diego Chara and Nico Lodero were like the two central midfielders that made the best 11, because Pasuelo, I think, is MVP and always should have been on. Any of those three, though, deserve to be there. I agree on Tannerholm. And the other one defensively that stands out to me is Ryan Hollingshead, left back at Dallas. I think he has 3 goals, 3 assists, or 3 goals, 5 assists, something like that. But he's been awesome the last 2 months going forward, played in midfield in the playoffs, showed his ability on the ball, all those things.
Isn't it a bit weird how important fullbacks are in this league as well, that they're not, like, I feel like the style.
They're like the sixth man in the NBA, where every good team has hit on them, but you don't build through them, and so no one thinks about it. And whenever you get to the point where a team is good,
the Jamal Crawford.
Yeah, every time you get to a point where a team's good, you're like, wow, they really. You know, obviously Toronto's a good example. They really hit on Justin Morrow. Wow. This team, I don't know, Seattle really hit on Kelvin Leerdam. We always say that, but then we ignore the fact that that position matters, and we build, you have to build through the spine. And it's kind of like, you have to get lucky. You have to be smart. It comes down to a lot of like draft picks and homegrowns now at those positions. And I think the teams that are good, like Philly, nail those spots.
And finally, Dave asks, which European league will have the closest top four race?
I think we talked about it with England. It's going to be super competitive, and Spain as well. And I still have no idea what's going to happen in Italy. Milan, they've continued to take every challenge that's been put in front of them, and they continue to win. At the same time, Zlatan gets hurt this weekend after scoring 2 goals. And what does this team look like without him? And at his age, how many games is he going to play over the course of this year? Juve have looked suspect. Inter Milan trailed Torino, who had a 4-string striker on 2-0 before they came back and won 4-2 in a wild game. Napoli's been up and down as well this year. And Roma, I think, surprising to me, I thought they were a year away, look like they might be a contender for the title. So those three leagues are all going to be complete crapshoots. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
David hit on everything I was going to say, yeah, so I will shout out Jonathan David scoring for Lille in a 4-0 rout over Lorient. He's playing with Yusuf Yazi, a Turkish 23-year-old attacking mid who I desperately want Arsenal to sign, but that partnership is very promising. And I think things are looking up for JD in France, so great to see that over the weekend.
Here's an interesting stat. I think Jonathan David has 3 assists or 2 assists this year. But Lille has never lost the game he started in, and they've lost 3 games that he's not started in. So it's like, clearly he's had a positive effect on the team, even when he hasn't been scoring. And you could kind of see the celebration on this one. It was just the like point to the sky relief. Obviously you're up 3-0, so you're not really going to push it. But if he can score a couple, I think he's going to stay in the lineup because he clearly matters for this team and the amount they spent on him. So he's going to get opportunities. And I think that's why I'm not worried about him still.
Shout out David for this episode. My favorite quote, he mentioned Dementors and eating chocolate. so that's my favorite.
Nick, are you Hufflepuff? No, you're Ravenclaw.
You know what? I've always wanted to be a Gryffindor, but let's be honest, I'm a Hufflepuff. Like, it's, I just know that.
I get Gryffindor sometimes on those tests, and that's how I know I don't answer them, honestly, because there's no chance.
Would you guys be stunned if I told you I have not read or watched Harry Potter?
Oh my God, Devang.
People look at me like I've committed a crime.
Because, Devang, you've got that thing where once you've not done it and it's zeitgeist, you're like, I'm the person who doesn't do it.
It's not true. It's not true at all. and I resent the implication. You know what it is, David? It is the daunting idea of the mountain I have to climb. Did you even get
Have you seen
to
any of the movies?
No. No.
Wow.
Like, they're movies. Come on. What else are you doing right now?
Those are also long, though. I've heard that some of them are quite long as well, which I have a big thing against. If a movie's over 2 hours, get out of town. We're not. We're
Listen, we DeBeg, really... after what you told me you did this weekend, you definitely have time to watch these movies.
And I hope you say it. Nick, please say it so people don't assume that I live this nefarious lifestyle on the weekends. I was just watching sports, man. I was just watching sports.
DeBeg got caught in a web of his own lies.
Just open the pack.
Oh. All right, here we go. We have four cards. We actually have the same guy twice in one pack, which is funny.
Yes.
Mexican Luis Roberto Alves. Don't know who that is.
LRA, of course. LRA.
Yeah. All right. Luis Roberto Alves, also known as Zuginho or
wow,
Zagu.
That's great.
Nice.
Love that. That's
fantastic. He was a Brazilian born. Mexican national team player. You know, Giovanni Dos Santos's and Jonah's dad was a Mexican or Brazilian born Mexican international too. There you go.
Spain, Julio Salinas. Do you guys know who that is?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. All right. Wikipedia it up. As I say, the final card is someone that we know. Roberto Mancini.
Oh, how does he look? How's his hair?
He looks very handsome, not gonna lie. Yeah he's a good handsome looking man. Yeah.
Can I get a you Google him and he's got pictures of him being ripped at the age of 50.
Oh, I see that. I saw that too. I Googled it.
He's doing good work with Italy. Hopes are high again.
That team, they played phenomenal last week.
He's a perfect coach for that team.
They've got a young generation of central midfielders, Insigne. Obviously, center backs are coming through because it's Italy. That team's fun, and they're competitive. And it was cool to see them kind of like missing big pieces and guys like Bernadeschi like stepping up and playing well.
Perfect ending. That is it for this week. A David Goss masterclass from beginning to end.
I don't even know what that means.
A rating or review wherever you get this podcast would be wonderful for us. It helps get this podcast into more people's ears. We're also on Twitter @AFootballPod, as well as on patreon.com/AFootballPodcast. Join the club, get on the Discord, get the show ad free, and also help us keep the lights on as we continue onward into the end of 2020. For Nick, David, and myself, thank you so much for listening to the AFP podcast. We'll talk to you soon.